You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 25th of September 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo is brought to you in association with the Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Midori House and from just down the road from the Monocle Cafe. I'm Robert Bounds. On today's show...
Do you agree with the Bush Doctrine?
In what respect, Charlie?
Well, what do you interpret it to be?
His worldview.
The Bush Doctrine, as I understand it, is that we have the right of anticipatory self-defense.
Now, George Bush had a foreign policy doctrine, but Sarah Palin couldn't say what it was. After half a decade in office, does Obama have one too? Robert Fox and Matthew Jameson give us their takes. Plus, we'll meet Daniel Alpert, author of the new book, The Age of Oversupply.
Enormous capital flows moving from the advanced world into the developing world has come back in to buy bonds, and that capital glut has forced down interest rates to the point where effectively money is free.
Also ahead this. Martin Morales, Peruvian food and music mastermind, will join us for coffee and conversation at the Monocle Cafe. All that, plus a look ahead to the rest of the day here on Monocle 24. That's Aperitivo with me, Robert Bounds, right now. That is all coming here on the next hour here live from Midori House in London. But first, at the top of the hour, it's news time with David Spencer.
Rob, thank you very much indeed. Monocle 24 News, I'm David Spencer. Forensic experts from the likes of the United States, Germany and the UK have been called in to help the Kenyan authorities investigate the militant siege at a shopping mall in Nairobi. 67 people are known to have died, among them six security personnel. But officials say it's likely there are more victims, with some bodies believed to be buried in rubble. Five terrorists are confirmed dead, with more in custody. Interior Minister Joseph Olelenku told a press conference that they had taken measures to try and stop further attacks.
Concerns have been raised about border security and general security in the country. I want to categorically state that we have heightened security, not only in all vital installations, but across all our border entry and exits within the country and in the airports.
The death toll from Tuesday's powerful earthquake in southwestern Pakistan has risen to more than 320. The quake struck Balochistan and was felt across South Asia. It destroyed houses and cut communications and was so powerful it caused a small island to emerge from the Arabian Sea just off the Pakistani coast. 11 Islamist rebel groups in Syria have announced they won't recognise the authority of the country's main opposition alliance. They say the Syrian National Coalition can't exercise any control from outside of Syria. But the coalition said the signatories of the statement do not represent the majority of the opposition. Russian President Vladimir Putin says 30 Greenpeace activists arrested for staging a protest at Russia's first offshore oil platform had violated international law, but he suggested they should not face charges of piracy. That's after investigators said they had opened a criminal case on suspicion of piracy, a crime punishable in Russia by up to 15 years in jail. The activist ship was seized and towed to shore on Tuesday after two tried to scale the platform to protest against Russian plans to drill for oil in the Arctic, which they say poses a threat to the fragile ecosystem. Ivan Blokhov from Greenpeace Russia is concerned those detained have not been allowed to have access to legal advice.
People were not allowed to talk to the detained activists last night when activists were delivered to the shore. And today, lawyers was informed that two activists are demanding a meeting with the lawyers. Lawyers was also not allowed to talk to activists with the exception of five people, although the lawyers have appropriate documents to represent the interests of the people.
A French minister has defended comments he made about the country's Roma, or gypsy, population. Interior Minister Manuel Valls called for them to be expelled, saying that few Roma could ever integrate into French society. He's been criticised by Amnesty International, European Commission and a senior colleague, but the 51-year-old said he saw no reason to take back his comments. The state of Ohio in the US has used its last dose of a lethal drug to execute a convicted murderer after a Danish pharmaceutical company cut off supplies due to objections to the use of the drug for capital punishment. Harry Mitz Jr. had been on death row for more than 18 years for the murder of two men. Ohio now has to have a new drug protocol in place before its next scheduled execution in November. Texas, which executes the most prisoners each year, is already due to run out of the Danish drug in the next few months. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
And you're tuned in to Aperitivo right here on Monocle 24. We've got a lot of Obama talk to get through. Stay tuned.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai Monocle, vada se ti cece.
From London.
London, caralho.
De Londres.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Aperitivo. The time is 2:06 a.m. in Tokyo. It's 18:06 here in London and 13:06 lunchtime. It's a lunchtime chat in New York City. It's time now for us to take a fresh look at the top stories around the world today. Joining me here in the studio is Robert Fox, defence editor of London's Evening Standard, and also Matthew Jameson, consultant fellow at the defence think tank RUSI. Welcome both to the programme.
Hello.
Brief. It says brief hellos in the script, and I think
hello.
You kept
hello.
It very no, you got it, you got, you, very cute. It's the briefest hello of all time.
You got a summer cold grunt from me.
Is it a summer cold?
Yeah.
We're going to get through it.
Yes, I think, so. I've been touring battlefield sites in Europe, and it was Mr. Rain and Mr. Sunshine by turns over the weekend. Serves me right.
Exactly. Well, we're going to get onto the subject of more contemporary ones, possibly, or avoiding them, regarding Obama's speech. It was the day of the big speeches yesterday at the General Assembly. Today, everyone is scrambling to read between the lines before we get into the nitty-gritty details of what Barack Obama said. What, gentlemen, were your first impressions, Matthew?
Well, I was struck, first of all, by how he only mentioned Asia once, given the fact that his first term was very focused on the pivot towards Asia. So that was a bit strange. He seemed to devote a lot of time to the Middle East, and I think he has absorbed the lessons to a certain extent of the interventions over the last 10 years. But what was very interesting was he actually came out and said that America should not retreat from the world. So even if there is a sort of an isolationism gripping the public or in the Congress, he was saying that actually we can't abdicate our world role or else these problems will get a lot worse. So that was quite interesting.
I mean, Robert, I mean, we're going to move on to Asia at the end of our allotted half an hour. We're doing it in stages. But presumably the Middle East is the elephant in the room. That was the thing that everyone presumably would be expecting him to talk about first and foremost.
Which, to go back to the Cairo speech of 2009, apart from that, where he thought in this populist way, yes, we can, the way he campaigned, that's what the message to the Middle East was going to be. On the whole, I think Obama thought that he could avoid it. And I think this has persisted, I mean the Middle East,
yeah.
And I think this has persisted for a very long time. And despite things going very oddly with the coup that isn't a coup in Egypt and so forth, there is still this vestigial reluctance on the part of Obama, which he didn't quite dispel in this speech. Because he talked about engagement. Now, for goodness sake, who did he follow? Who should he really have been engaged with?
Yeah.
And he made polite words about him, and we're talking about Hassan Rouhani. And Hassan Rouhani simply, it must be said equally, gave a more or less content-free speech as much as Obama's. But it was
you didn't have to read between the
but
lines.
But it was much, much cleverer because that's what he was doing. Tabula rasa, this is what I'm going to work from, and I'm not going to tell you what my cards are. The trouble is with Obama is, to me, he's getting more and more like that great English comic, Tommy Cooper, who used to do these wonderful tricks on the stage and say, just like that, and they went terribly wrong. A card trick, and the cards would fly all over the place. Ever since the Syria vote in the UK Parliament, which has affected Obama very badly, and then his non-vote in Congress, the cards keep shooting out of his hands and going all over the place.
There's another great thing that Tommy Cooper used to do is when he used to get in a London taxi, he used to get to 10 quid and he'd go, I've only got 9 quid on me, can you reverse back up the road a bit? Do you think there is a sense that Obama wants to backtrack away from this? Because obviously he wanted to be a proactive president, coming up with intelligent policy, knocking a lot of nails on the heads when he first came in, and now these bumps in the road keep
appearing. Don't want to make this sound like an extreme love-in, but this is a very, very good analogy. And there was a very direct clue in what he was saying. We sort of might use military force, he was saying, but we don't really think we should be doing it now. And he has got, as has Cameron, very badly in a terrible mess about projecting hard power in support of a difficult and contested foreign policy initiative. And he is backing up the road, so it's only 9 quid. Dead right.
And what this is to both of you. I wonder whether you felt that UN speech was, how much that UN speech of his was addressed to the American public, because he said that the American public is not interested in getting involved in foreign wars and getting stuck in the kind of, we're going to come on to the Bush doctrine later, but that idea of preemptive strikes, of getting embroiled in things before they've even hit off properly. How much do you think it was designed for the rest of the members of the UN? How much do you think it was designed for the American public to watch that speech?
I think it was primarily aimed at the international community and to foreign governments and foreign policy elites, because I don't think probably the American public would pay much attention to the goings-on in the United Nations General Assembly. And so I think that was the message that was very clear going forward from that. But, coming on to Robert's point, he is suffering from a great credibility problem, especially after the botched process surrounding whether or not to engage in a military intervention in Syria. And he's really not a war president in the sense that he wasn't elected to be a war president. He campaigned on a platform of ending American involvement, in the Iraq War and Afghanistan. And he's not temperamentally suited to this kind of, these issues of war and peace. It's almost like he was coming across as too much of a Hamlet figure during the whole Syria crisis, dithering and, one day one position, the next day another position. So as a politician and as a sort of a statesman, he's really not suited for this kind of role in terms of leading from the front on military matters.
What we're going to do, to put this into some context for everybody, we've got a clip. This is what Obama said yesterday.
The United States has a hard-earned humility when it comes to our ability to determine events inside other countries. The notion of American empire may be useful propaganda, but it isn't borne out by America's current policy or by public opinion. Indeed, as recent debates within the United States over Syria clearly showed, the danger for the world is not an America that is too eager to immerse itself in the affairs of other countries or to take on every problem in the region as its own. The danger for the world is that the United States, after a decade of war, rightly concerned about issues back home, aware of the hostility that our engagement in the region has engendered throughout the Muslim world, may disengage, creating a vacuum of leadership that no other nation is ready to fill. I believe such disengagement would be a mistake. I believe America must remain engaged for our own security, but I also believe the world is better for it. Some may disagree, but I believe America is exceptional, in part because we have shown a willingness, through the sacrifice of blood and treasure, to stand up not only for our own narrow self-interest, but for the interests of all.
And that was President Barack Obama addressing the General Assembly of the United Nations yesterday in New York. I'm joined by Robert Fox, defence editor of the London's Evening Standard, and Matthew Jameson, consultant fellow at RUSI. Robert, you were making a bit of a face while that was playing out. What does that mean?
He said, "I'm not withdrawing." He did sound a very, very reluctant man. I'm in a real situation, to take the Brer Rabbit analogy, the tar baby is there and she's stuck to me and she's not going away. It sounded desperate because he doesn't want long commitments, because remember GWAT, Global War on Terror, morphed into the long war, and he wants no long commitment. And actually this is the major criticism of what he has on Syria, because it's not a strategy on Syria. He's got a non-strategy. And it's a position he shares with David Cameron. In both their speeches of late, sets of speeches, they have not been able to describe whether you strike over weapons of mass destruction, the chemical weapons, or not, what the second and third order consequences are. There's something going on in both countries. There is real tension with the military, where there are arguments on both sides, particularly once, despite all the oddities of the decade of war, as he called it, on the side of the military. What Obama and Cameron are showing, having in common, is they cannot evolve strategy. Grand strategy is mil-pol, but strategy at the accepted level, as James would say, is actually how you maneuver armies, how you back policy with force. And this is absent. It's very interesting, just to explain, when both he and Kerry started talking about this limited itsy-bitty surgical strike, as if it was keyhole surgery.
Yeah.
And Cameron spoke in the same way. It doesn't happen like that. Mm-hmm. Ryan Crocker gave an excellent interview.
This is to placate an unhappy public, presumably. Yeah. You can drop one bomb, it will go down a chimney and that'll be it.
That's what he was also trying to say to his Democrat congressmen and women, who are desperate about his shilly-shallying because they think it's going to lose them re-election at the half-term stage, which is only a year away.
Mm-hmm. Well, can I ask you a question? This is just a quick one while we head to the idea of an Obama doctrine, if there is such a thing. Whether Prime Minister Cameron and President Obama are hamstrung with their relations with the military, presumably because there isn't enough cash, or there isn't the public desire to spend cash on the military to be seen to be doing these things when no one's got enough money to pay their heating bills, perhaps. Does this actually go down to this when people are making speeches in the United Nations and trying to placate their public?
Are you asking me first?
I am, yeah.
I'll be very clear about this. You're quite right. They are very, very expensive things, and they are seen by Treasury secretaries and Chancellors of the Exchequer particularly, and they're very important and they've come into strategic policy making, which they never should be. People like Macmillan, Margaret Thatcher, curiously, would never allow that to happen, nor would Dwight D. Eisenhower. They are very expensive things. And that is why in this generation, which is a totally non-military generation, Obama in Vietnam, Cameron, the nearest he got to the military was the Eton Rifles, I think. And I'm not, that sounds like a sneer, but it is literally true. They look on a lot of this military thing as a bolt-on nuisance. I was talking to a general at one of these ceremonies I've just been at Arnhem, somebody I've known for a long time. I first met him on the battlefield at Goose Green, where he was the mortar platoon commander. I've identified him, so I've got to now be quite careful. And he was saying that as he ends his military career, he thought the conception of strategy wasn't there as to what you want your armed forces to do and what you can afford and how you go about it, because you talked about money and engagement and policy. The one thing that really is lacking, and it is around in the military, as James would tell you, is imagination.
What I wanted to ask you then, Matthew, let's move it on to this idea of the Obama doctrine. We're going to play a clip of Sarah Palin not knowing what Bush's doctrine is, to put it into a bit of context for me as well, as our listeners. This is Sarah Palin being quizzed on the Bush doctrine.
Do you agree with the Bush doctrine?
In what respect, Charlie?
The Bush, what do you interpret it to be?
His worldview?
No, the Bush doctrine, enunciated September 2002, before the Iraq War.
I believe that what President Bush has attempted to do is rid this world of Islamic extremism, terrorists who are hell-bent on destroying our nation. There have been blunders along the way, though. There have been mistakes made. And with new leadership, And that's the beauty of American elections, of course, and democracy, is with new leadership comes opportunity to do things better.
The Bush Doctrine, as I understand it, is that we have the right of anticipatory self-defense, that we have the right to a preemptive strike against any other country that we think is going to attack us. Do you agree with that?
Charlie, if there is legitimate and enough intelligence that tells us that a strike is imminent against American people, we have every right to defend our country.
Well, that was the sound indeed of legitimate and enough intelligence. I'm getting some smirks here from Robert and Matthew in the studio. That was an ill-defined version of the Bush Doctrine, but at least he had one. It was this idea of preemptive strikes.
American exceptionalism behind it, as Palin is the epitome of, yes. I don't know what Captain John Smith of Massachusetts in the 17th century, who first talked about it, would make of Sarah Palin.
Well, we have to. We've got to discuss, therefore, what the Bush Doctrine might be. There was some editorial in the U.S. press, New Yorker and New York Times today about this. If there was a Bush, an Obama Doctrine, what do you understand it as, Matthew?
Well, I don't really think there is one, as Robert and I were just chatting about earlier.
He's literally
on.
Scribbling on the back of the cigarette packet as we speak.
Yeah. Well, you see, because if there were one, I think what you could describe it as is the United States engaging in a multilateral fashion through international organizations such as the UN or NATO to build coalitions and alliances to deal with all the various problems around the world and to put diplomacy at the forefront and to really backtrack and degrade the military option. So it's the very, very, very last thing that you go to. And when you do, it's very limited and you're working in concert with a lot of allies and institutions, as we saw in Libya, leading from behind. I think that would be what the Obama Doctrine, if there were such a thing, be constituted as.
And I suppose Obama and the United States still has that, still has the single world superpower status that it can allow France, maybe, and UK to kind of go and put their wellies on and get out onto the battlefield before, but they can stand as the power behind it, and they will maybe give their blessing or not. Is that, do you see that as part of the role, Robert?
I see it completely differently. It's complementary.
Because you don't wear wellies on the battlefield.
Yeah, complementary. I think Obama, being the kind of man he is, supreme intellectual, pointy-headed, not to say intellectually arrogant, would love to have a doctrine. Would love to have something as coherent as that, but he's struggling. And as you so eloquently said, Matthew, that it requires allies. He is very bad with allies, including Brazil. Mm-hmm. You know, that he just does not know how to mix and match this. He does not know the thing that one of his mentors always said is smart power, the mixture of hard and soft power, Joe Nye. Mm-hmm. He just hasn't got there. And there's a wonderful story about when Adlai Stevenson, the great Adlai Stevenson, was going for the Democrat nomination at a convention in Los Angeles. And the Mr. Fixer, sorry, this is a Tommy Cooper type story, was Jesse Unruh.
He's getting some royalties in the show.
Who was very, very famous. And he was Mr. Los Angeles. And they were in the room beforehand. And Adlai asked Unruh, do you think I'm going to make it? And Jesse Unruh turned around and said, you know, Adlai, you won't make it because you're too goddamn on the one hand and goddamn on the other. And you see with Obama, it's this perpetual intellectual faffing around, whereas the reality on the ground, and this is a military appreciation, whether it's Syria, Tunisia even, but certainly Somalia, Kenya, and above all Egypt, is just running away from him. Yeah. He is trying to pay the £9 taxi fare. He's trying to go back to the immediate end of the Cold War when you can make these structures work. Mm-hmm. Exactly as Matthew says, they know they've got to make the structures work. In today's world, NATO has to have an agreement with Putin. The UN has to be all embracing. It has to make to work with China so they can embrace rogue powers, and they do look pretty maverick, like North Korea. But you cannot do that if you preach exceptionalism. And I'm surprised he did, because that's where Putin nailed him in the statement, very well worded article. I don't agree with all of it, in the New York Times by Vladimir Putin, because behind him there is one other exceptional power whose exceptionalism America backs. And it really is the joker in the pack, Israel. Mm-hmm. So what I'm saying is that what you've got is what is called, in new management speak, a wicked problem. And you know what a wicked problem is? As opposed to a knotty puzzle, a wicked problem is where you get layer upon layer upon layer, and they impact, and the impaction makes it impossible. That's what the recipe, according to Obama, sounded, and it didn't sound like a doctrine.
We've got a wicked problem here. We're going to have to go away on a short break to do some team building, build some rafts, stuff like that. You are tuned into a show called Aperitivo. It's coming out of your radio on Monocle 24. I'm joined by Robert Fox, defence editor from London's Evening Standard, and Matthew Jameson, consultant fellow at RUSI. We're going to be talking about what Obama thinks of Asia in a second.
Inspiring the likes of Charles Dickens since 1824, the Glenlivet may be the definitive Speyside single malt whiskey, but that's just one chapter of the story. Master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting the Glenlivet's global community of whiskey connoisseurs to help curate the flavours of their next limited edition whiskey, The Guardian's Chapter. To discover more, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
It's Aperitivo. It's 1826. It's Monocle 24. I'm Robert Bounds. I'm joined by Robert Fox from London's Evening Standard and Matthew Jameson from RUSI. Back now to Obama at the UN. What was curious yesterday was that he mentioned Asia only once in the entire lengthy speech. It was referenced to only very, very briefly in terms of a good economic model for development. The big strategic move of US foreign policy in recent years has been a turn or pivot from the Middle East to Asia, leaving behind the counterinsurgencies of Afghanistan and Iraq, and looking to big naval strategy vis-a-vis China, the Koreans, the Philippines, and so on. Matthew, you brought up Asia, or its lack of it, in Obama's speech right at the top of the show. Was it conspicuous by its absence, not just for Asia watchers, but for people that have been tracking Obama's foreign policy relations?
Yeah, it was strange. It was bizarre, because one of the great things, I think, about the first term of the Obama administration was that it did set out to, you know, shift the emphasis and the attention and the investment to Asia, away from the Middle East, because actually, you know, the Middle East is going to be declining in terms of strategic significance for American interests, especially as the it becomes less dependent on Middle Eastern oil. And the huge power center in the 21st century is going to be in Asia. And so the United States has got to get back in there and revitalize its alliances, and it has been doing that very successfully under Hillary Clinton, though John Kerry is now focusing more, a lot more, on the Middle East again rather than Asia. So I found it very curious. I think it comes back to Robert's point. You know, the problem with Obama, President Obama, is he doesn't really know the difference between showbiz and strategy. And he's not a strategist, just like David Cameron is not a strategist. And we've seen this over the last month. They are way out of their depth. They're overwhelmed by events. It's no surprise, really, because let's remember, President Obama had no foreign policy experience when he came into the White House. He had very little national experience. Remember, he was only in the Senate about a year and a half before he started running for president. And before that, he had been a state senator in Illinois. And his team, it just seems to be all over the place. It's so incoherent. Like the point about American exceptionalism, he doesn't believe in American exceptionalism. He's joked about this in the past. He said, sure, I believe in American exceptionalism, just as the Brits believe in British exceptionalism or the Greeks believe in Greek exceptionalism. So he's not really committed on that point. And there was that schizophrenia which came through about, you know, being the world's policeman. But he had said many times before, we can't be the world's policeman, so, you know, make up your mind. And now with the lack of Asia, it seems as if, again, they're all over the place. Are they going to go full throttle and engage in Asia, or is it back to a more Middle East-focused foreign policy?
Do you think Obama would rather be talking about Asia, though? Do you think that he sees Asia as somewhere to hold close, to do business with, to build some new strategic ports in the region, et cetera, especially with the rising power of China, rather than be having to put out these fires that he's frankly dancing around in the Middle East, Robert?
I think the problem with China is the power has risen, and they ought to make up their mind about that. You look at what's happening, and it's been reported very little here, as the ISAF and NATO pulls out of Afghanistan. It's a very good example of this. China subtly, slowly absolutely vehemently is moving in, grabbing assets, marking their own, marking territory, almost mercantilist in its approach. I think also...
It's definitively mercantilist because it doesn't have to be the policeman of the world.
That's right, that's right. And this is a great problem, excuse me, for Obama, because he has hit a brick wall in several respects. Foolishly, I think they didn't spot that the pivot stratagem for Asia was going to invite a naval arms race. The US, are in a terrible, terribly difficult position, the UK to some extent, because the big wing carrier group is no longer what it was. There are things that Matthew will know probably better than I do. The defences of surface of land-launched, very long-range, surface skimming, supersonic moving to hypersonic missiles, even the chess game, even the board games of Dover Patrol and L'Attaque and all these things, they've gone. They've changed totally. Plus, it is very, very difficult to see where this new Chinese leadership is taking us. Mm. What is their attitude to American debt? Just before, we were hearing a lot of nasty noises about they didn't want to buy this junk, these junk bonds. They were very worried about being linked with America in that way and becoming Chimerica. But Chimerica is a reality. And there's something that's astonishing about Obama as an American president. Think back to the Monroe Doctrine. He isn't bolting up his backyard. He's doing very badly in Latin America of late. And so... I'm sorry, if I'm giving you the impression he's all over the place, that is my view. He's all over the place.
We're going to have to leave it there. That's the sort of quite the soundbite to leave it on. Robert Fox, defence editor of London's Evening Standard, and Matthew Jameson, consultant fellow at RUSI. Thank you so much. I hope that was an engaging chat. It was from this side of the table. Thank you for joining us here at Midori House. We're going to take a very weeny teeny break. We'll be back in a second.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
All right, there's still plenty to come in the second half of today's Aperitivo. We'll be heading to the Monocle Cafe to talk about Peruvian food and music with Martin Morales of the London restaurant Ceviche, and we'll preview what's coming up on today's Globalist Asia and the Monocle Daily. Before we get started on that, here's David Spencer with the world news headlines.
Thank you very much indeed. The Pakistan military is helping rescue efforts in the southwest of the country, where more than 300 people have been killed in a powerful earthquake. It struck on Tuesday in the isolated province of Balochistan, close to the border with Iran. Teams of forensic experts from around the world have been called in to help with the investigation into the siege at a shopping mall in Kenya. So far, 67 people are confirmed dead after the four-day assault by Islamist militants, but it's thought more bodies were buried when part of the building collapsed. The Western-backed opposition Syrian National Coalition has played down a statement by other rebel groups, rejecting it as their political representative. 13 groups, including at least three previously considered part of the coalition's military wing, the Free Syrian Army, signed a statement saying the National Coalition can't represent them from outside of the country. A team of European Union inspectors has been in Gibraltar to investigate a border dispute that has strained relations between Britain and Spain. In a row which began over fishing waters, Britain and Gibraltar complained to the EU that Spain was applying overly zealous border controls, causing long queues. Low-cost Vietnamese airline Vietjet has agreed to buy up to 92 Airbus aircraft in a deal worth about $8.6 billion. The deal for A320s will run between 2014 and 2022 and is a move to beef up its presence in a fast-growing regional market. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Aperitivo, where we are live on Monocle 24. It's 21:34 in Moscow, it's 18:34 here in London, and 14:34 in Rio de Janeiro. Now, each day on Aperitivo, we leave the comfortable confines of Studio One here at Midori House, and we'll be heading down the road to the Monocle Cafe on Chiltern Street to meet Martin Morales, who's the founder of Ceviche, one of London's most popular new restaurants located in Soho. He's also just launched a best-selling Peruvian cookbook, and he runs Tiger's Milk Records, a music company dedicated to discovering artists from Peru. Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck, is ready and waiting with Martin down at the cafe, and I'll throw to him in the style of David Frost talking to Lloyd Grossman. Andrew, it's over to you.
Thank you very much, Rob. And actually, we do get a chance to have an aperitivo down here, unlike you, stuck back there in the studio. So, bad luck. I'm with Martin, and despite that name, Martin, he's a true Peruvian. Your dad was English, I believe, and your mum Peruvian. Now, before we talk about the restaurant, how come suddenly Peruvian food seems to be travelling around the world?
Well, it's been a long time coming, really. It's been, I'd say, a few years. I mean, our cuisine has been around for 2,000, 3,000 years, so it's about time. But it really started with a group of Peruvians in Peru saying, look, our food is excellent. You know, Escoffier said it was one of the best in the world years ago. And we believing in ourselves that we could create something very, very special that can be successful and exciting in wonderful cities like London. So there was no one else that did this before we did in my small team. And we just said, look, we're frustrated that there's not a great Peruvian restaurant here in London, so let's do it. So we started with pop-up restaurants. And then, you know, we found a fantastic, fantastic site on Frith Street in Soho. And it's been wonderful since then.
So does the name of the restaurant describe exactly what you get when you come to that restaurant? Is it all about ceviche?
No, the name of the restaurant is ceviche. Ceviche is a marinated fish dish that's our national dish. It's one of the most exciting dishes, I think, in the world because it's full of zesty, it's healthy, it's vibrant, it's packed with flavors. And that hopefully reflects all our cuisines, although our cuisine at Ceviche includes Japanese Peruvian cuisine, which is called Nikkei. It includes Chinese Peruvian cuisine, which is called Chifa, some Afro-Peruvian dishes, as well as dishes with influences from Italy and Spain, but and as well indigenous dishes from you know, that come probably from the Incas and before that. So Ceviche incorporates all of that as a restaurant, but the dish is also very special. So we are specialists in that dish that's a national dish from Peru.
So tell us, how come you're a man who came out of the music industry, you don't have a big track record in restaurants, but I was reading the reviews that people are nuts for it. Everyone's saying it's like the best restaurant to open this year, I don't want to go anywhere else. How come you pulled that off, you know, as a kind of novice almost?
Well, I've worked in restaurants and bars when I was younger. I've been a waiter, I've been a silver service waiter, I've been a cook, and I've been a barman, and I've ran bars when I was, you know, I was at university. I've also run events. I've been an event producer, an event organizer. The last event was a European tour for a major music artist. So I know how to produce events, put great people together to produce something very special. This here, Peruvian food, Peruvian kitchen, ceviche, our restaurant, is so close to my heart. So I'm going to do my very, very best. I'm going to go out to kill for it in a way, you know, without, you know, actually doing it. But no, but just passionately communicating what we do and putting the best people possible together and enjoying that experience. And I think our customers are seeing that. So when they come to our restaurant, when they hear something that we release as a music label as well, or read, you know, our lovely book, they can feel that passion and that energy and the quality of what we do.
So as I was saying, there is a new cookbook and another restaurant you're just about to announce opening in the east of the city. Tell me, when you translate what it means to be Peruvian and Peruvian-ness, as it were, the temptation for outsiders would be kind of condors and panpipes and God knows what. But how do you translate contemporary Peruvian culture so when people come to the restaurant, they realise they're not just in another trattoria, that there is something Peruvian about it without it being a cliché?
We have a very special spirit because we have come from thousands of years of culture, of heritage, and of suffering. And in the last 20 years, things have been going better for our country. So we as Peruvians are very proud of that and are very excited of that. We've been humbled already. So we're coming out of that with a lot of pride and a lot of love, you know, to give to people through our food and through our culture and through our creativity. And so that's who we are. We're positive. I think we're new Latin cool, if you want to call it that, or something like that. It's not the kind of old sort of, it's just about dancing and it's just about fiestas and all that kind of Latinness. It's a new pride that we have, which I think is exciting and comes across in our fabulous food and atmosphere and the vibe that's in our restaurant, which is just genuine.
Well, I hope you've got people booking for the restaurants and booking for the book. But let's just finally talk about the music. This is Tiger Milk, and this is, you've been supporting lots of really amazing artists from Peru, and you've kindly chosen one of the songs. Quickly tell us what this song is and why you've chosen it.
Well, we've got a new compilation coming out on Tiger's Milk. It's called Peru Maravilloso, Marvelous Peru, Peru Maravilloso. Vintage tracks from the 60s and 70s, really hard to find. This track is really interesting because it's by Lucho Neves and his orchestra. It's a mambo, Mambo de Machagüey. Now, that song is covered across the Americas, but not in this way, because it's got mambo and huayno, a very traditional Andean genre. So it's got all of those two in combined, which is appropriate because we're about to launch a restaurant called Andina in Shoreditch, which is going to champion the culture and the music and the food of the Andes.
Well, thank you very much, Martin Morales. Rob, we're going to pass back to you, and I think me and Martin are slipping off to Soho. Bye.
That's more like it, isn't it? That was the first track from Tiger's Milk Records' new release, Mambo de Machagüey by Lucho Neves y su Orquestra. Up next, we'll be talking to Daniel Albert, author of The Age of Oversupply. And oversupply of what? We'll find out after this break.
The Glenlivet was the first single malt to successfully cross the Atlantic Ocean. And since that first journey, the world-renowned whiskey has never looked back. Now, master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting their global community of whiskey connoisseurs, the guardians of the Glenlivet, to help create their next limited edition whiskey. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
You've read the magazine, you've listened to the radio, and you've even made it to our new cafe. But now there's more, so much more. Hitting bookshelves this September is Monocle's first book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living. It's a quiet manifesto for doing things well that runs from the macro to the micro. Over 400 pages of fresh editorial, great illustrations, and stunning photography. We look at what makes a great city, how to build a home you'll always love, why it's good to have a Shiba Ken dog by your side and a cocktail from the Dragonfly Bar in your hand. The Monocle Guide to Better Living will be available in good bookshops around the world and is also available to order now at monocle.com. Happy reading.
It's 1844 here in London, which means we're enjoying an aperitivo. I'm Robert Bounds. Since the global economy dipped, or rather plunged into crisis in 2008, unemployment has risen and growth around the world has slowed. In the new book, The Age of Oversupply, Daniel Alpert, a Wall Street banker, argues that the biggest obstacle to restarting this growth is the unprecedented global explosion of cheap labour and cheap money. Monocle's Thomas Lewis wanted to know who's to blame and how we can get out of this mess. He caught up with Daniel of Monocle's New York Bureau.
So let's unpick the title of your book then, Daniel. Oversupply is the greatest challenge to the global economy. Can you explain that for us?
Yeah, I guess this sort of quick elevator pitch on oversupply is the notion that about 20 years ago, something happened, a little more than 20 years ago, that really was never considered possible by economists, and that is that some 3.5 billion people who were either in purely socialist or communist countries or in countries that were leaning towards socialism suddenly moved into the free market and began to compete with extraordinary volumes of labor that was willing to work considerably cheaper than labor in the developed countries. And as you know, as everyone knows, became the global manufacturing base for most manufactured products. And in certain countries such as India, even became a service exporter where the advanced nations could not keep up from the standpoint of wages. And so what we've developed over the course of the last many years, and I would say probably the inflection point is somewhere around 1997, and sort of the 10 years later with the financial crisis, you saw the outcome. Basically, China and the other BRIC nations, together with many other second-tier countries, have effectively deprived global labor in the advanced countries of jobs. And as a result, there's been several derivative effects, one of which is enormous capital flows moving from the advanced world into the developing world to purchase products has come back in a capital glut, back in to buy bonds in the United States, the UK, and Europe. And that capital glut has forced down interest rates to the point where effectively money is free. And you see the effect of that quite demonstrably in the fact that we have now all of this massive, extraordinary monetary easing policy where central banks are intervening on a huge scale that nobody ever considered possible before, and yet we're not experiencing inflation. And so it's really wrapping that whole thing up into one package. We call it oversupply, but as a practical matter, it is the excess of labor, of productive capacity, and of capital relative to demand for all three.
So if that, as you put it, has contributed to the wobbles, if that's not too flippant a way of putting it, in economies around the world, what's a reasonable and practical solution, would you say, therefore?
Well, if you have excess resources, the key is how do you most effectively utilize them? I don't think the UK is any different than the United States in the fact that our infrastructure is not as good as it could be. We have excess labor. We're likely to have more of it. Wage bases in the United States, real wages have been falling since 1998. It's a very long time to have people actually earning less on an inflation-adjusted basis. And so consequently, we need to find a way to utilize those excess resources to sort of stop out the decline in wages, get people reemployed. And the only way to do that is to consider alternative means, looking at the private sector as a way of increasing employment in the age of oversupply is a very unfulfilling prospect. The private sector has no incentive to invest in new capacity, which creates new jobs, if in fact we're in an environment of overcapacity.
But we do hear that private sectors around the world are gradually, admittedly at a slow pace perhaps than many would desire, but that private sectors are gaining strength. Does that actually therefore mean that there is hope for oversupply and that the unemployment figures that are at eye-watering levels in many countries actually has some scope of declining?
Well, I think if you look at what the, quote, private sector, unquote, has succeeded in, it's succeeded in improving earnings based on efficient utilization of offshore labor. You know, the classic example that everybody points to is the U.S. company Apple, which manufactures nothing in the United States, collects some very attractive, what are effectively design and development fees, which is the spread between what they can sell their goods for and what it costs them to manufacture it, and employ very few people doing it in the United States. And so while that's a very trite example, it's a particularly good one, and it extends to companies in all the developed nations, with the exception of Japan and Germany. And of course, the success of Japan and Germany is really something that can be chalked up to their willingness to adjust, restrain in the first case, in the case of Germany, and actually adjust in the case of Japan, their wage rates. I mean, Japan's experienced on and off deflation for nearly 18 years, that it has enabled them to continue to price their goods and maintain a trade surplus. Germany, not that much different. The only difference is that a lot of the success of Germany was due to the institution of the euro, which is sort of an artificial situation in which they've tied their European brethren to them through a currency. Thank God the UK didn't do that. And that currency has enabled them to effectively capture a huge percentage of demand based on their own efficiencies and then export their capital to poorer countries. And we all know what happened after that. The poor companies overconsumed and underproduced and took on too much debt. And we're now faced with this terrible situation of unraveling. Had the Deutschmark continued and the euro never had come into effect, it's very unlikely that Germany would be in a trade surplus situation today.
And that was Daniel Alpert, author of The Age of Oversupply, and one of those people that can talk continuously for 8 minutes without an or an ah. And he was talking to Monocle's Tom Lewis. We'll be talking about what's coming up on Monocle 24 in a jiffy in a sec. And they call that a sting in radio terms because you didn't know it was there and then suddenly it stops and it stings you. I'm joined by Dominic Reynolds, who's presenting The Globalist Asia, and Barbara Feeney, who's producing The Monocle Daily. Welcome. This is by way of introducing what's coming up in the schedule. Later on in the evening. Dom, you're going to go first because your show comes first. What's
happening? Thank you very much. And we're racing to prepare it.
Are you? So this is a bit of an inconvenience for you, really.
To be honest, I'd rather be upstairs. 69 minutes to go until we're on air. We're going to start by talking about the problems that Japan has been having energy-wise. And the solution, it seems, is Stephen Harper. So Shinzo Abe and Stephen Harper have been having a bit of a chat about supplying a bit of gas.
So you've got to tell the listening several, who is Stephen Harper?
Stephen Harper is the Prime Minister of Canada.
Some of these people that, you know, read a smaller type of newspaper.
Yeah, true.
And people like me might not have known that.
Okay, so Robert Bound, culture editor, me, the presenter of The Globalist Asia, Stephen Harper, the Prime Minister, and Shinzo Abe will be sorting out their energy future, essentially. And it's obviously an interesting time for Japan. Post-Fukushima was 25% nuclear. Now it's 0% nuclear, so big questions there.
And what's Stephen going to be bringing to the table?
Well, Stephen has he's had a lot of people knocking on his door because Canada
is he a log man?
He's got logs, he's got gas, he's got all sorts of things, and he's got lots of people who want a bit of it.
Okay,
and so they're going to be having some chats. The other interesting item of many on the show: Jason Strother's got a package from South Korea in the city that's taken away cars for a week. For a few people, they've said, "Give up your cars for a week, get on your bike, walk, and see how you get on." Because
where is it? Is this in Seoul or is this in a smaller town?
It is outside Seoul,
right,
in a city I'm not going to name. Not because I can't remember.
I always wondered. I've been to Seoul a few times. It's a great place. It's very reliant on all sorts of sort of 21st century transportation. I've never seen a Korean on a horse.
Well, there we go. I don't think it's like, let's get horses being used more, although that may be a happy byproduct of this situation. But yeah, we're going to the idea is that life will improve, the quality of life will improve, as will the pollution levels in that city.
I like that. That's living up to its name. That's the Globalist Asia.
There we go. Do you want a quick rundown of what
else
is there?
Yeah, okay, let's give us
Aviation Expo in Beijing. We're going to be talking the UN General Assembly in Good Evening America, and pork in China is being purchased. That's the trail.
I always thought the Chinese loved a pork.
They do. That means the value of it has gone up through the roof. Lots of hungry mouths to feed, so there's been an acquisition.
Invest in pork, cats. That's my top tip. I could be doing the business news, couldn't I?
You could.
I could be on a different show entirely, just
very
doing business.
Slick. You're wasted in the cultural world.
I know I am. Dom Reynolds, thank you very much. And what time can people be tuning in to hear you talking about that lovely stuff?
It's now in 66 minutes, so that's 2000 hours London time.
2000 hours, okay.
Apparently we say it like that.
Get thee to the army. Barbara Feeney's also here.
Hello,
she's Rob. Going to be producing The Monocle Daily. When's that on? That's on at 10 o'clock, isn't
that it? That is on at 2200 hours.
Here you go, okay.
We're going to stay in that fashion.
Let's stay in that fashion. And what's going to be on that show, Barbara?
So, Rob, we're going to look for Ban Ki-moon. Have you seen him? Do you know where he is?
No, I haven't. Well, last time I saw him, he was the only Korean I've seen riding a horse.
Really?
Oh, I'm just referring back to Dom's show.
Well, maybe that's where he is because...
So he's MIA.
Well,
who's seen Ban Ki?
He's not lost, but we're just kind of going to ask, you know, what has he been doing? Where has he been? He's sort of a dull, colourless figure. And, you know... We're just going to...
This was
written in an article today. So we're going to kind of pick that apart and kind of ask, you know, what has he done? You know, he followed, you know, after Kofi Annan, I suppose it was a tough role to fill. But
it's not like he hasn't had enough things to get involved in, but he doesn't necessarily seem to have been there involved.
Yeah, he's been on the sidelines, but especially with things like Syria. He has done a few good things, but, you know... He's kind of stood on the side a lot.
He's the quiet man of the UN, isn't he?
Exactly. And, he, you know, it is a tough job. But then do we look to the people who selected him and say, why was he chosen?
I wonder who selects him. Them? Who's that? Who's the selection committee?
We'll find out tonight.
That's the story I want to go and do.
Yeah, I think we should look to those people and say, why did you choose him? He's not doing a great job.
Who chooses the choosers with Barbara Feeney?
Exactly.
What else is coming up on the Daily, Barbara?
Then we're going to go to Valencia in Spain.
Were you doing an accent there? Was that?
You know, I was trying to sound authentic.
It just sounded like you got a cold.
Stop it, Dom. This is properly. Come on.
Excuse me. You had your time, so let me have a little bit of time to talk.
This is where Monocle producers squabble. It's the end of the show.
So we're going to Valencia because there's been a bit of a debacle over Calatrava. Mm-hmm. He has some beautiful buildings in the dry riverbed of the city.
Oh, yeah.
And they look beautiful, but they're not very functional. So, you know, we're going to talk...
Is this a contemporary architecture? Isn't that good? Shocker.
Yeah. Okay. You know, there's peeling paint, there's people slipping on bridges.
This is where they've interviewed the cleaners and they realise that they're Henry the Hoover nor their Dyson. Does it get into any corner in this? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
This is the problem that they had at the Guggenheim in Bilbao, where they interviewed all the cleaners and no one could get into the corners of this Frank Gehry designed building that everyone loved, but no one could clean.
So it looks great,
and
but not very practical.
Exactly. There you go. I think we've come to our allotted little spot on what's coming up later. So, Dom, you're doing a kind of big countdown. You're on in, 67 minutes or something here?
63 now. So
look
come
at him.
On.
He's good with the maths, isn't he, Dom?
You've got a big clock there.
Yeah, I know, but I can't read that. And Barbara, the Daily is on. Who's presenting the Daily this evening?
The Daily is Dominic Reynolds and Andrew Muller.
Oh, right.
So Andrew Muller's going to be doing the heavy lifting. I'm just there to interrupt him with irritating comments.
Double trouble. That is what's coming up on the rest of the schedule. Thank you very much, Dom Reynolds and Barbara Feeney, for filling us in. That's all we've got time for in this edition of today's Aperitivo. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Robert Fox of London's Evening Standard and Matthew Jameson from RUSI. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Alexa Feminich and Harriet Thorpe, and our studio manager was Alex Funnell, and Bill Luty was in the cafe. Next after headlines, the entrepreneurs. Today, Adrian Craddock is in Western Australia to meet a man who's invented a wetsuit that repels sharks.
There's one guy who we've been talking to who's actually going to help us do some testing. He's had 26 great white engagements in the last 5 years. He said, we wear the cage, we wear a shark shield, the electronic device. If there's another layer of thing that we can add to this that may work, then we're more than happy to put these things on.
That, just hearing that, is giving me the willies. I'm not willing to wet toast that wetsuit. Then at 2200 hours London time, we'll have the Globalist Asia as discussed. Then at 2200, the Monocle Daily, produced by Barbara Feeney, as discussed. As this show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 London time. But for this edition of Aperitivo, for me, Robert Bounds, thanks for tuning in.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.